podcast with the real world meets the digital world as we explore the intersection of spatial computing and AI. Let's welcome our host, Andrew Ballard. Over to you, AB.
Well, g'day and welcome to episode 25 of Spatial. If you're watching this, it is a lot darker, or my coloured lights are a lot brighter, something's happening. Yes, it's my evening. Why? That's because I'm talking to a very special guest today, Paul Stevens, coming to us from sunny UK. Yes, I get to use those two words together in the one sentence. Paul, g'day, how are you? Welcome.
Oh, hello. Thank you very much for having me. It's great. I'm very well, and it is indeed sunny. In fact, we're having a little heat wave. So a lot of confused British people.
Okay. Heat wave. Must ask the question. Weather check. What do you mean by heat wave per se?
What's well, a UK heat wave? Well, yesterday it was 31 degrees.
Oh, okay.
Which is very uncomfortable for us British folk.
That is everyone to the beach. Everyone grab the flannels and start to, yeah, okay. Well done. 31 would be, yeah, okay. That does count as a nice heat wave. Well done.
Wow, that's saying something from somebody who's used to heat waves.
True. Days of 40 aren't bad when you get 5 days in a row. And I can say it plainly, when the can of beans in the middle of the house in your pantry is also 40 degrees, when the heat has just leached in from every side, that's a good heat wave. But still, 31 UK, you get top marks for that. Now, for the record, Paul and I met a couple of months ago. We actually met at a, let's call it a conference in, let's say, Northern Europe. That'll do. But we actually, like ships passing in the night, we both, I think, heard each other's five-minute intro lightning talk, and then we're in different streams the entire few days. And on the last day, we must catch up. We must have a chat. This is that chat. This is the time to actually finally do a final deep dive to actually ask all the burning questions which didn't get to ask back then. So, Paul, you are CEO of Voltitude, which is a lovely company which has an awesome name, and I love the fact that you've got yourself, Paul Stevens, and then your two of your partners are Stephen and Stephen. Your meetings must be Steve-O, Stevie, and pretty problematic.
Yeah, Stevens.
There you go.
Yeah, we need to work on our diversity statement.
Oh, okay, yes. Gotcha.
People other than Steve are allowed to join Voltitude.
Nice.
Although
nice.
It may surprise you that there are a total of four Steves in a 12-man team.
Okay. So it's you've hit the KPI for the year. I think even for the decade. So well done. Voltitude does some astounding work, and it is definitely in an area of geospatial AI data science that is literally on the edge. It quite literally is. You are playing with the highest of altitudes. You are playing with the highest of latitudes. Can you give us a easy, then a medium, and we'll save the hard explanation for where do you play? What are the sort of things that you're actually doing?
Yeah, sure. So to tell you the story of why we are obsessed with the stratosphere and what you can do with the stratosphere, I'll just fill you in a little bit about my background, how I got to here.
Awesome.
So prior to 2020, I was working for Airbus on the Zephyr program. So Zephyr is a solar-powered high-altitude pseudo-satellite. And what they mean by that is that it is a very special type of plane that can cruise day and night only on the energy it's collected from the sun through very efficient solar array and hold that in extremely high specific energy density batteries. And by building such a craft, we can effectively create a near perpetual flying machine with interesting properties. It's a bit like a satellite in that it's got a very large field of regard, but it has aerial resolution. So it's an interesting blend between the resolution capabilities of aerial sensing and the huge swath and low cost per meter square of space.
Yes.
And so we were developing this platform for Airbus. And I must say it was a two decade obsession to make it work. And I was the head of design. So I had a career high in 2018. When we demonstrated all the key enabling technologies that come together and made it possible to design an aircraft that could hold itself in the stratosphere, cruising day and night on and balancing this delicate energy budget. So you might say, well, why have I changed, disrupted the ecosystem and disappeared from what was an amazing program?
Mm.
And yeah, it was simply two aspects, really. One, I was really interested in opening up the stratosphere to other applications, which were perhaps not only defense-related and not only connectivity-related. I was really interested in Earth observation. And number two, although we have demonstrated the energy budget aspect of designing these aircraft, which I'll explain in detail in a moment, although that aspect had been solved and we could now hold a plane in the stratosphere day and night for months on end, the type of aircraft that can do this are extremely vulnerable to gusts and turbulence when they climb to and descend from the stratosphere. And this vulnerability I saw as the Achilles heel for the entire industry. And we thought that there was the next challenge was to solve that, but without detriment to its performance in the stratosphere. Wow. So, I loved working for Airbus, but there are certain things you can't do in a big corporate environment. And so my friends, my colleagues, my design team, basically we've joined up in Voltitude. We've made a clean break from Airbus, and our challenge is to open and unlock the stratosphere to a whole range of new applications and to overcome this Achilles heel for the industry so that we can expand the operating envelope of these unusual aircraft. And so that's the story of how I got to here. And so I'm joined in Voltitude by my former design team from Airbus. We're still on talking terms with Airbus. We're not persona non gratias, fortunately. And the journey since then has been to test the utility of the stratosphere for interesting new applications. Wow. And one of the first applications we wanted to explore was getting really high-resolution meteorology data from remote areas. And so we took a step back from fixed-wing solar electric flight, and we have started to explore the benefit of really, really small, low-cost, largely biodegradable natural latex balloons and their ability to float for many, many days in the stratosphere and reach, just through drifting with the winds, reach remote areas and to then dispense tiny meteorological sensors called dropsondes, which fall all the way down to sea level, transmitting their observations back to the balloon, and then that data is then disseminated via SATCOM, and we receive that, do some quality checking, and then send it out to our data customers.
That's phenomenal.
And so it's a reinvention of a very old idea. So cast your mind back to the 1940s, in the thick of World War II, perhaps, and as a terror weapon, the innovative Japanese were launching barrow-triggered vented balloons to drift in the jet stream across the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, across the USA. And
drop incendiary devices onto the USA. I don't know for certain if anyone's ever killed, but as a terror weapon, it was incredibly effective.
Gotcha, yeah.
So we thought, well, let's not terrorize people with these things.
Good.
Let's try and do the opposite. And let's try and solve societal issues and help improve the forecasting of extreme weather events. And so what we've done is fit a standard meteorology balloon, a latex weather balloon, with a vent and a ballast bag so that it can control its height.
Wow.
It doesn't go up and burst. It controls its height. We can set a height which corresponds to winds that are desirable for our drift direction to take us to an area of interest. And then we can drop tiny, tiny dropsondes. Our dropsondes are about 20 grams in total. There are some insects that are heavier than these dropsondes. And these dropsondes are stored for many days or weeks at a time in the stratosphere. We resuscitate them, we warm them up, we charge their battery, and then we dispense them. And about 20 minutes later, they have fallen all the way down to sea level. And all that way, they measure temperature, pressure, humidity, wind speed, and wind direction.
Wow.
In very high vertical resolution.
Yeah.
And all of that data is then collected, and we send that to our data end users. And it's all in near real time.
Oh, look, I must say, I'll put the link to your products page in the first thing within the show notes. Stratosonde, am I saying that correctly?
Yes, yeah, combination of Dropsonde and Stratosonde.
Stratosonde trademark, like that. But the images there, I mean, you really are showing pennies and, yeah, pence there for size. So how long can that parent balloon stay aloft? What's the sort of the mean range of days, or is it measured in weeks?
So those balloons, they're really basic. It's a very high value system. So okay. it's a bit like the explanation for why do they have finite life? If you can imagine this ball of buoyant gas, every day when the sun sets, that gas ball cools. And it loses buoyancy. And to prevent it from sinking all the way down to surface, it has to throw out some things it doesn't need anymore.
Yep.
And so we dispense sand.
Gotcha.
So sand trickles out of it and falls away, and that reduction in mass catches the drop in buoyancy. And so every day, a bit like compound interest, negative compound interest,
you're just paying it forward, and eventually you get to a point where... Gotcha.
It runs out of ballast, yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So days or cycles? Do you measure in days or sun cycles?
Yeah, we get about... In the tropics, we get about 5... sunsets.
Wow.
At high latitudes, we get a few more, maybe. In theory, we should be well in excess of 10, but we find that the UV degradation of the latex envelope then also causes it to burst.
Okay.
And so really, you can only really count on about 5 or 6 days. And in that time, you've got to be able to drift to somewhere interesting. And regularly dispense your dropsondes, and we carry up to 10 dropsondes on these balloons. So it's and they're really small. You know, one person can launch them. It's a very low logistics footprint. And if you've ever watched a meteorologist launch a standard weather balloon, it's exactly the same thing.
Yeah, gotcha. Gotcha.
Yeah, exactly.
Any priming exactly of the? Is there much of a CPU or a black box, or is it just comms and hardwired and? It's just a slave.
Yeah. There's a little computer on board which manages everything. There's a default mission plan, which usually works for most missions. But if it doesn't, once airborne, our operations base in Farnborough can send it a new mission plan, and so really it's a case of somebody who really knows nothing about the system can inflate a balloon with buoyant gas and release it. They don't really need to be able to program it or anything like that. It's very hands-off, very simple. And then it's all managed centrally. And indeed, we don't even have somebody watching it all the time. We have a computer generating a mission plan for each balloon.
Wow.
And that's worth probably talking about, because it's crying out for its own talk, which is all about machine learning and artificial intelligence on planning routes through a complex wind field.
You have the platform, please. So yeah, you've got time, you've got altitude, you've got the cycles to contend with. You haven't got battery life per se. But how do you chart four dimensional? We'll just stick with that.
Yeah,
a complex.
I'm afraid
path.
We do it. I'm going to disappoint you really badly here because we're a bunch of Luddites, and what we do is a large scale Monte Carlo simulation, where effectively we tell synthetically a balloon to change height to all possible altitudes within a certain resolution.
Yeah,
and every 6 hours it changes back to all other possible altitudes, and this Monte Carlo simulation of all possible outcomes for this balloon over the next 5 days is computed. It's an n to the power of y problem
choices. Yes.
But with modern computing, this is done within a few seconds.
Yeah.
And so there's a probability map of where the balloon could go with a, and so we highlight where we want it to go.
Yeah.
And all paths of truth that lead to that location are identified.
Given the score, and of course we can, and those that aren't.
We can weight each branch mm-hmm. and say, well, what's the common factors here? Which branches in this decision tree hold the greatest likelihood of getting to where we want to at the right time?
So you've got it down to a mission set and forget. You can tell it what the mission vaguely is, and unless it goes outside those parameters because of Hurricane X comes along, chances are it will converge close to that mission profile.
Yeah, and of course, the world's heartbeat for meteorology is about every 6 hours there is an update to the global forecast. And of course, in 6 hours, the balloon has made some progress along its planned track. And so every 6 hours, we automatically rerun the mission planning system with fresh data, with progress. And that is then fed, progress and fresh data and differences are fed back in to create an enhanced track prediction. So in a sense, we are vectoring in as time goes by. But the whole complexity of this is rife for modern thinking and modern machine learning principles and artificial intelligence and so on and so forth to be thrown at this because as our constellations get larger, it's inconceivable that we should be doing this on a balloon by balloon basis,
gotcha.
And that there are almost certainly better ways to do this
to coordinate the.
So
how many do you have up at any one time? If it is.
Singles,
but if it is in known numbers, it's a great thing to always ask a potential client, what number would make you change your thinking? So 10x, some people go, 10x is fine. Okay, well, if that's fine, how about 100 or 1,000x? At what point in time would you have to transition to using it like a, and here's the gnarly question, what's the collective noun for a group of smart balloons?
I'm not sure, but I know what the collective noun for stratospheric scientists are, and I'm sure it's probably something like a disaster of, of stratospheric engineers. Our busy summer year is the tropical cyclone season in the Atlantic, and we're hoping to branch out services into the Pacific. But at the moment, we rarely have more than between 5 and 10 balloons airborne at once. So with the numbers nice and low, we can take this rather clunky methodology and keep it going in an automatic sense that humans really don't have to, aside from launching them and deciding at an executive level what the mission should be, humans are no longer interacting with
it.
The drop zones are scheduled. The path of the balloon is automatically being modified and evolved in response to new forecast data and progress. But the answer to your question is, at what point does it become, do we need to evolve?
Yeah, where is the next epoch or the line in the sand where, okay, now it's time?
It's really soon. It's really, really soon. It's, if we are successful in expanding services to the Pacific, we really should be doing it straight away.
Lovely.
And related to your previous question, which is why are the balloons only 5 days endurance because of this, compound interest effect of cooling on the buoyant gas? Well, there are other innovations in balloon technology which could benefit from being reinvented in a much smaller form factor.
Wow.
And we're exploring really small super pressure balloons, which is another type. So what I've been talking about is a zero pressure balloon. It's a balloon which has a vent in the bottom, effectively. And if it wasn't for the fact that latex is elasticated and trying to squeeze the buoyant gas out of itself, if it was just a polythene bag, this would be called a zero pressure balloon.
Okay.
And it's one where each day that cooling effect causes it to have to dispense ballast and retain its buoyancy. A different type of balloon called a super pressure balloon is one where the envelope and the gas inside it is under a small pressure, and that pressure is large enough such that even during that cooling cycle as the sun sets, there is still a positive overpressure in that envelope even at the coldest point of night.
Right.
And by achieving this, the balloon does not change density. And so they're often called constant density balloons. And what we have there is a really long endurance balloon able to float almost indefinitely if it wasn't for effusion of buoyant gas through the balloon film.
Right.
And so this is if you think of perhaps some of the really large balloons you might have seen doing scientific missions, operated by the likes of Aerostar International or even the Chinese spy balloon that we all became familiar with
came down
2 years ago.
2 years ago? Yeah, gotcha. Yep.
Yeah. Those were examples of super pressure balloons, very special super pressure balloons, which are able to fill and empty a ballonet inside them and to control their height and benefit from this remarkable feature, which is that they don't change their density on sunset, to give really long endurance and altitude control. And so one of the technologies we're exploring is what is the smallest balloon of that type that you can design practically,
gotcha.
And
it has all the requirements and is still the back of a single person, back of a car, the graphical comical Swedish furniture maker instructions, not a list of instructions a mile long. The super pressure balloons, are they sizes of, like, are they managed by teams on the ground? Are they tenfold size today?
Yeah, at the moment, the smallest commercially viable super pressure balloon is carries about a 50 kilogram payload underneath it,
right?
And is a really large envelope. We're talking maybe 15 to 20 meters in height, and a really huge volume of buoyant gas is used in that process, and it requires a substantial team to launch these things.
I
would say it's still pretty tactical. You could turn up with a Land Rover or a truck with all the equipment needed to do that, as well as another truck with all the buoyant gas cylinders.
But yes.
it's a tenfold, maybe even hundredfold increase in the effort to get one of these things airborne. But they're a mature technology.
And they can last 10x times.
They can last for I think the world record is about 250 days.
Goodness, right? Okay,
so which is really impressive, really impressive. And hats off to those people. I think the average is more like 60 days. It's a really interesting field of endeavor. High altitude balloons are afforded an unbelievably welcoming to aviation by the regulatory community. The regulations are common sense, not the sort of thing that you find in conventional aviation. They are very operational risk assessment. It's very enlightening. Yeah, it's about the operational risk assessment and ensuring you operate your balloon in a way that is safe for the general public, knowing that all balloons end their lives in what aviation would call a catastrophe, a crash. They will always fall from the sky, hopefully under their parachute, and that's the end of their life. They're a single-use system.
Yeah.
But remarkably, the regulatory world has embraced this principle and afforded huge freedoms for innovation. We see, the effort to miniaturize super pressure balloon technology
Absolutely.
To something that's really quite small and tactical and as sustainable as possible as a potential new and disruptive delivery system for environmental sensors.
Absolutely.
You'd need
10 or 20 times the number of the SONs, the small
yes, you would,
sensors.
Yes, yeah. Precisely,
need,
yeah.
And then you would need better comms and better mission planning push them in the right direction for longer. So
it's a real challenging system engineering optimization process. An altitude changing super pressure balloon needs a compressor, and a compressor that works up there in the stratosphere at 30 millibar.
Gotcha.
And it needs solar arrays, it needs rechargeable batteries, and it needs a mission system. And it needs this high-tech envelope, which is ultra-thin and ultra-lightweight and able to withstand the mechanical strains of this overpressure that keeps it in this constant density mode, but also allows you to fill and unfill a ballonet to deliberately change its density, to change its altitude and actually navigate.
Yes.
And so there's some minimum capital of mass of system to go into this product to make it viable. And in the system engineering optimization space, it's very easy to chase your own tail into nothing and find that you produce a brilliant system, but there's no payload capacity or there's no excess power to provide for a payload.
Correct. It's almost the opposite of the famous line of the best part is no part. That's true, but when you're left with just a balloon, you've won, but also you've removed the bits that make it viable for all the other requirements.
And it's probably no surprise to you or anyone listening that the available mass fraction of a system like this available to its payload gets smaller the smaller the overall size of the platform. So at some point, it is just not possible with current technology to make it smaller than a point of commercial value. And we're exploring that point at the moment with some projects we're running. And exploring whether or not they offer disruptive new services for Earth observation and meteorological data collection. I should mention that there's a sort of regulatory. I've said the regulations are very lax. There are regulations, and a really convenient threshold is for meteorology balloons. Is if you can operate in what's called the light category, which is where your total payload mass has got to be less than 4 kilos. And payload is considered to be anything that's hanging under your balloon. So it's not just your box of tricks that are paying you your livelihood.
It's all the things
it's that everything
hang
else.
Onto that, it's all the mechanicals.
Things. All the mechanical things and everything. All the critical systems to make the balloon work. And so four kilos is a key threshold because the world in 1945 at the International Chicago Civil Aviation Organization's inaugural conference set out some rules of the air.
Gotcha.
And they said that balloons of a light category used exclusively for meteorological purposes can be allowed to cross international state boundaries.
Wow.
Without prior permission.
Okay.
And so this is like a revelation of global freedom for a balloon in a light category can go anywhere without prior permission.
Yeah.
You must ask for permission to launch it from your launch state, but once it's airborne, it's allowed to go anywhere. So being in the light category and engineering a balloon that can be so light that it can do all these amazing capabilities in that tiny weight constraint...
Yep.
Suddenly opens up global freedom. So that's the exam question. I don't have the answer yet as to whether there's a commercially viable solution.
Well,
but we're doing some great prototyping, and we are optimistic that there is a system hidden in there somewhere that allows us to open up a new application to the stratosphere with a tenfold capability improvement over our existing balloon.
Looking forward to that. And also you mentioned Earth observation. So, of course, dropping little droplets, 20-gram things behind you that can sense is still, astounding. I need to talk to you about comms in high altitude and high latitudes. But what sort of Earth obs would you be thinking? How do you put you don't want a wide-angle camera, you want the longest super zoom in the smallest package? Are there throwaway cameras of that nature or parachutes and you retrieve? What's the size, weight and power? What's the delicate balance you're aiming for in that kind of world?
Yeah, I should say we're probably not seriously exploring conventional Earth observation using the principles of remote sensing, a long focal length optical system staring down the Earth's surface and retrieving
on the basis that you can't
imagery
100% control. In an area facing a direction, but beyond that, that's correct.
Yeah.
Aussie terms, it's the vibe.
We are we do use our balloons for test and evaluation purposes. Indeed, we have a steerable parachute. So when we carry a high-value payload to the stratosphere, we can conduct multi-day tests at a really low cost because our balloons are so cheap. And we've got a reasonable chance of not just navigating the balloon to within land, but then releasing this steerable parachute and navigating that back to do a spot landing and retrieve a high-value payload. So you can imagine the industry of fixed-wing solar electric high-altitude pseudo-satellites is still in its infancy, and there are a lot of payload developers exploring the solution space, which is a really demanding size, power, and mass envelope. And there are very few successful operators of these planes at the moment. So there's a very long waiting list to get to the front of the nose of one of these aircraft with your payload.
Right.
And that's not very helpful if people want to do a real-world full system test
before
the embarrassment of its failing on one of these precious flight opportunities. So there's a mini market in providing test and evaluation services on balloons. And I would say that's probably the only time that we remotely get close to what you would describe as Earth observation using multispectral, hyperspectral sensors. However, I would say that our efforts and technology relating to fixed-wing aircraft to expand their operating envelope, which I can talk more about, and to get those aircraft more regularly transitioning through the troposphere to and from the stratosphere more successfully, opens up all kinds of commercial applications which currently are priced out because the platforms are just so vulnerable and they keep crashing.
And what are the modes to make that more rugged? A two-stage, a high-density atmosphere, low-altitude transitions to a different mode of working, or a way to protect or pardon? I mean, that's the toughest power to wait ever, surely.
Yeah. So I'm hoping you'll love the simplicity of the solution that we are pursuing. So when you analyze why these aircraft crash when they've encountered gusts and turbulence, it's very rarely that they were not strong enough. The problem they encounter is that by prioritizing within their design this energy budget in the stratosphere, the need to be able to cruise on so little power, and we're talking powers equivalent to human-powered flight. I'm sure you've seen these athletes pedaling as fast as they can to get airborne and cruise at just above walking speed.
I went
speed.
Down the YouTube rabbit hole a few weeks ago. I'm going to say Japan, and I'm going to say 60 kilometres a birdman in a cycle, and then he just kept on going. Yes, he had to stop
amazing.
Because his muscles were cramping up. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. The English Channel used to be the reference mark for success, but these modern athletes doing this sport are doing, 60 kilometres, which is huge, a huge distance, but they are superhuman. They're able to produce a lot more useful mechanical work than certainly I can. But so it's a very similar problem. How do you close that energy budget in the stratosphere? The answer is fly with minimum power required to cruise. And casting your mind back to your school years, I'm sure you'll remember that drag, aerodynamic drag, is proportional to velocity squared.
Yep.
And if you can still remember these classic physics equations, power is drag times speed. So a velocity squared for drag times speed again is a velocity cubed term.
Yeah.
So the power required to cruise is a V cubed relationship.
Speed.
So the biggest lever you have is to reduce V.
Right.
So you have a really slow flying aircraft. Up there in the thin atmosphere, it has to fly pretty fast to generate lift. But it's still, it's still got to get there. And the design space solution is it ends up with a really wide wingspan, very high aspect ratio, and incredibly light and very, very low wing loading. And a with a distributed mass. So it is, you know, there's no central point like a passenger carrying aircraft where there's a fuselage where everyone sits.
Yep.
And there's strong, stiff wings holding that. You can't do that with these aircraft. You've got to distribute all of your mass uniformly across this flying wing. And the net effect is it's incredibly easy to deform. It displays very strong aeroelastic properties.
Okay, wings twisting.
What I mean by that is that
serious
wings
flexing.
Twisting,
yeah.
deforming, bending, torsional effects. And and that's a byproduct that comes from prioritizing the minimization of mass on your aircraft. And the issue there is that when a plane of that type encounters a gust or some turbulence, it might be designed with a little bit of dihedral. A dihedral is a sort of V-shape to your wing.
Curve,
and it gives, that's great. And it gives your aircraft roll stability. It means that even with no flight control system on board, a roll will generate more lift on the downward hanging wing, naturally restoring it to stable flight. And so most aircraft are designed with a shape in mind that gives them their optimal flight control authority. And the problem with these really aerelastic aircraft is that when they encounter strong or moderate or even light turbulence, the effect can be that their shape changes completely.
Right.
And the aerodynamic derivatives, the stability characteristics of this
can
new
shape. Can
actually
be lost momentarily or for, yeah.
Yeah, it could be lost for many tens of seconds. We're talking about a very slow train crash in most instances.
The super slow motion.
Nothing happens slowly.
Yeah.
And the problem is these aircraft, once they've lost their stability characteristics, they find themselves in a kind of divergent runaway situation.
Right.
Where they might have lost roll control, they might be entering a spiral dive. They've got no way of coming out of it because the shape has changed to one of zero roll control. It might have even turned to, instead of having dihedral, it might have gone to anhedral.
Yep,
and so this poor aircraft...
Uniquely unstable, suddenly.
And so it just gets faster and faster and faster until eventually it just breaks up. There's too many aerodynamic forces on it and the structure fails.
Wow.
And so, the step one in our solution is to tell the aircraft what its shape is. So, MEMS technology is super light, super lightweight. It's a key enabler for this solution is to cover your aircraft in sensors that allow the aircraft to know its shape.
Wow.
And the second attribute of our system, our solution, is to give the aircraft an ability to change its lift distribution across its wing to allow it to vary its shape back towards its idealized shape.
Wow.
So if it finds itself encountering a gust that deforms it in some way, maybe makes it bow in the middle or even accentuates its dihedral, we can get the aircraft to sense that deformation has occurred and actuate devices which will change the lift distribution to restore the shape, to give it flight control authority back, to control its flight envelope.
So adding a few more percent of mechanical help in those extreme situations to pull it out of the, deadly deforming.
So actuators usually cost you mass, and, people are familiar with some of the actuation systems on a conventional aircraft. They've probably heard of ailerons.
Yep.
So ailerons are a trailing edge device. They sit on the trailing edge, and when they move, they impart a torsion into the wing. Now, normally wings are stiff, and all the planes that you and I travel on, for all intents and purposes, they're really stiff, strong aircraft. And ailerons are great for that. But on a highly aerelastic aircraft, like a solar powered HAPS platform, ailerons are terrible because as soon as they deflect, they impart a torsion, the wing will twist, and they can result in
control
surface reversal.
Turn it into an oscillating mess,
it'll just be a disaster. And the only way of making such devices work is to stiffen up your structure and add more and more mass. And eventually, You can no longer close that energy budget in the stratosphere.
Gotcha.
So we've been thinking about ways in which we can control this lift distribution, control the lift generated by all parts of this wing without imparting torsion into the wing. That's the key factor. And I'm sure you've heard of a spoiler. So a lot of cars have spoilers on. They dump lift.
Yep.
When I was 18, I had a very, very underpowered car. And I fitted it with a spoiler. I didn't need it.
No, but it looked fantastic.
But I thought it was cool.
Yep.
So spoilers are really great at destroying lift. Okay. And they're really simple actuation devices.
So
they don't need to be very strong.
You can actively put some, pretty much a binary off-on, flick it into the airstream to just suddenly bring things back in milliseconds.
So little fences can pop up here and there to disrupt the lift. And so for very little, sophistication in your actuation system, you can really have quite profound disruption of lift for very little mass or electrical power. And that's why dumping lift is a really great solution to the exam question, which is how do you dynamically vary the lift distribution of an ultralight aerolastic aircraft to control the shape of that aircraft as it transitions through turbulence and gusts and other features.
Well, my follow-up exam question is, do you train such a system? Sorry, are there known rules for such a system? Is it a Monte Carlo? Is it a known set of if this, then that? Or does it have to be put through simulations and, dare I say it, small AI ML to try and simulate this thing up in the upper reaches and find ways to...
So there is a solution derived from conventional control theory with a super loop around your conventional flight control loop, which is maintaining the shape of a plane.
Yeah.
However, the really sexy part of this is that there is the potential for AI to preempt based on some sensory inputs, particularly if you're able to sense disturbances before they've even reached the wing. So just like a meter in front of the wing edge, there is the potential to have a signal that says, the last time this happened, it was strongly correlated with the following events.
So we will.
Why don't we preempt that?
Things like radio interference between the nose and the wingtip, things like that, or?
Potentially, yeah. This is an area that we are road mapping into our technology. At the moment, we're trying to get the conventional control theory solution working in an optimized way. But using old school engineering, the results are dramatic. We're able to halve the bending loads in a structure compared to a system without this technology, and we're able to double the speed envelope.
Wow!
So we are able to control an aircraft back inside its normal cruise range from a position that would have been disastrous without the technology.
Wow.
And so suddenly this means that these aircraft are a lot more robust. They still fly very, very slowly because the drag is still the enemy of the power budget. But they can withstand moments of very high-speed flight and safely control themselves back inside that conventional flight envelope using this technology.
And while the effort to make them still might be intense, they are long-lasting, but the fact that you will have the confidence to know that it will be up in the air for longer and survive squalls and survive the unknowns better, that certainly makes it a much more viable per-payload proposition.
Yeah. I should admit, though, that like everything we do, it's a reinvention. And anybody listening to this who's... a keen bird spotter may have watched large wingspan birds soaring on the winds, and they may have noticed that when they hit a gust, they let their wing deform. They let the wing take a new shape.
Yep.
The bird's bones are connected by tendons, and those tendons allow the bone to at the joint to deform. If they didn't, they would break their wing. You know, the loads would become too great. They'd snap a bone, they'd die. So they let their wings deform into new shapes and shapes which would not allow them to control their flight envelope.
Yeah, gotcha.
And so a bird is covered in sensors.
Momentarily.
Every single feather.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every single feather is a sensor for them.
Yeah, gotcha.
It's connected to their nervous system. They have acute awareness of their wing shape. They've got acute awareness of the lifts affecting their wing. And so they follow exactly the same algorithm. They yeah. sense that a deformation has occurred, and their priority, when safe to do so, is to restore the idealized shape, then to restore their flight envelope, and then to restore navigation on their mission, which was probably gotcha. To yeah. hunt some small rodent that they were chasing.
And if that interrupts lunch, then so be it. They've lived for another yeah, day. Yeah. yeah, I think that gives you a definite good plethora of names for your next project. For the, I mean, we're talking condor. We're talking the largest of large birds. So, Paul,
yes,
that is a phenomenal journey from weather balloons with smart devices, the dropsons falling on a head the size of less than a coin, so we shouldn't be too worried. Going from that to from zero pressure to stable pressure. Gotcha.
Super pressure.
Cheers. And then going from the Chinese spy sat, spy balloon size, down to can your company make something that is, you know, truck single person deployable? And now not only have you come from the largest solar powered, long lasting stratospheric, fixed wing, you're now trying to already design the next flavor of, you know, better, faster, cheaper, or in this case, longer lasting and, you know, better bang for your buck.
More resilient.
More resilient, able to leap tall buildings and survive for longer. Paul, that is an astounding journey. I don't think we've actually touched the sides of it. I actually love to have a chat to you again in a little while, if that's possible, and we'll come back and talk about the communication sort of things you're doing, what data you can actually play with, and catch up and see where you're going on both those two next level challenges that you're facing.
Paul, yeah, sure. It'd be my pleasure.
Where do people find you? Where's the best place? We'll have links to Voltitude. We'll have links to LinkedIn for you. Any other places people need to reach out and find you?
Well, I'm usually fairly vocal on the conferences I attend. I go to a lot of meteorology conferences.
I must say, I've been living vicariously through your LinkedIn feed, Paul.
EGU is an annual one, so the European Geological Geosciences Union is one I frequent, and anything to do with tropical cyclones. So I go to those. So if you're interested in the stratosphere, meteorology, all those things I've been talking about, look out for me on LinkedIn and through our website. I'll be posting which conferences I'm going to. I'd love to meet up with anybody who's interested in having a proper, you know, geek to geek conversation about this. So you can probably tell I love to talk about this. It's a real passion. And I love the physics.
Oh, it's brilliant to see.
That's what keeps motivating me.
Such a field that is, you know, you wouldn't start as a teenager saying, I want to do this. This is obviously, you've just gone from one to another, but you're obviously seeing what's coming and you're getting ready for it. It's brilliant to see. It's heartening to hear. Paul, thank you so much for your time. We'll leave it there and we'll catch up with you hopefully in a couple of months, definitely when you've got the next product ready to go, but also we do want to talk about data and the data science coming off these devices.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's it from episode 25 of Spatial. We'll catch you on the next episode. From myself here and probably the plethora of cats that's been walking behind me, if you're on YouTube, we'll say farewell and we'll see you on the next episode. Bye-bye.
If you'd like more news and insights about Spatial AI or have a story or interesting topic you'd like us to cover, reach out to us. Or better yet, come and join the community at Spatial. All the links are in the show notes.